Harlem. Yeah.
Folks, thank you for tuning in to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you want to learn more about this project, go to the website lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything that you would ever want to know about this project can be found there. Every episode, every segment I've released, every platform you can listen to this podcast on, every social media site that you can follow this project on, everything is there. So please go check that website out. If you want to support this project, please consider doing so. This is a work of passion, something I spend a lot of time doing, and I care deeply about the things that I am speaking on and the people I'm speaking with. So please consider doing that. This podcast, again, ad-free, sponsor-free. I repeat that over and over again, and I feel like these introductions get a bit repetitive, and I apologize, but I just like to throw this information out there, which is that you can donate to this project. If you feel like this project is worth your money, if you feel like I am worthy of that, please consider throwing a few bucks my way through either the one-time donation, which you can find down in the description, the PayPal link. You can go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. You can make a one-time donation through that link. Or you can look down in the description. You'll find it on the website, but you can go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. And through that Patreon page, you can make very small or large or however size you want donations to the production of this podcast that is done monthly. So you'll do a monthly donation. And on that page, if you are a patron, you'll gain early access to the interviews, the conversations that I record a week in advance before the official public release. And on that page, you will find other extras that I throw on there as well. Rants and thoughts and insights and various other things that I like to do with this project. So please consider supporting this work. And for those that are who are already doing that, I have to thank you so very much. From the bottom of my heart, I thank you. I know you don't have to do it, and I thank you for it. Without any further delay, here's the episode. In this episode, I speak with Michael Sliva. Michael, I've become aware of his work over the past several years, and particularly since I started speaking and becoming friends with Rob Simetz, somebody that I've grown to admire for his work. He does his own amazing work with his own show, Moving Forward on PRN. But his familiarity with Mike and my kind of passing on familiarity with Mike inevitably led us together, and we finally decided to have this conversation, which we recorded. I think Mike does an amazing job of discussing, you know, the name of his book is Chasing Another Carrot, a manifesto for the predicament of privilege. And in that book, as we get into in this episode and his just overall experience in life, is to leave behind things that we don't need, that aren't going to provide any sort of fulfillment or happiness in this culture. Leaving behind, for instance, Mike left behind his career as a teacher. He left behind a regular income, a comfortable home, the familiarity and regularity of life as a teacher, as a person who has a career and a profession. And he left that behind because he understood the privilege that he has, the understanding that the position he has in his job and his life was in great part due to the fact that he is born within a place and of a particular skin color and background that gives him a certain head start in life, so to speak. And that's not all the reasons. I mean, he has a lot of reasons we get into, and part of his work is also addressing abrupt climate disruption, the near-term human extinction on the horizon as a result of abrupt climate change, and the decisions that he made as a result of that. You know, that's a great part of it. But the thing that we get into in this very specific conversation is how privilege still plays out even when you choose to leave behind all of the things that Mike has left behind. That privilege isn't something that you can just leave at the door when you decide to. Being a white male in America, you have a certain place within society, and that's really hard to just shake off. You really can't. And when one realizes that, there's a certain responsibility in recognizing this and addressing this. So Mike has just done an amazing job with his work. You know, he's co-hosted Nature Bats Last. He has, again, written this amazing book. He has his own series online that was just released through the Poetry of Predicament YouTube channel, was started by Dean Walker, who I'm going to be speaking with rather soon for an episode. He featured me on the Poetry of Predicament podcast a few months back. So I'm looking forward to that conversation with him. But Dean does a lot of different work, and he put all of these this video series by Mike on his channel called Another Way. So there's a few different episodes of this this series by Mike. Mike is just an incredibly articulate person. He's funny. He's compassionate. He's understanding. He has really deep insights into a lot of different subjects. And having this conversation with him was really fun. I really enjoyed it, and I really hope that we can continue the conversation into the future. I will turn people on to his book in the description down below. I'll have a link to that book. I'll have a link to his video series and his website. He has a blog which he updates with everything that he does. He updates fairly regularly. It's called Michael Sliva Speaks. The website is Michael Sliva. Now, Michael Sliva. Sliva is spelled SLIWA.wordpress.com. And again, I'll put all the links to his work down in the description. So please enjoy this conversation with Mike Sliva. Something that has been on my mind lately, and I wanted to get your perspective because of you have a very unique life journey that you've been on. I think a lot of people might be simultaneously envious of you, but also maybe a little perplexed by what you've done with your life and the decisions that you've made. But the thing that I wanted to get at is that you have stepped away from, as I think I've said earlier, was you stepped away from the center of our industrial civilization, our culture. You obviously still exist within it, and you definitely recognize that, but you've had a chance to sort of sidestep a lot of it. And something I've been really thinking about lately is how almost everything becomes subsumed in the logic of the system. Inherently, we existing within an infinite growth paradigm, our system demands that everything become a part of it in order to continue its existence. How have you grappled with this as you have moved further away from your initial profession and the maybe lifestyle that you had been living previously that many of us are familiar with? How have you grappled with the reality of the situation that we're in regarding the system that we are embedded within?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, because obviously my answer has changed since I left my job 7 years ago. You know, when I first left, it was sort of a response to not only my profession. I was a teacher, and I really just didn't believe in what I was doing anymore, because it had really become a test-based culture, high-stakes testing. And so I didn't really find myself, you know, being a lifer, so to speak, in that. And so I really kind of, and then colliding with that was the idea of abrupt climate change and maybe the end of the industrial model, and, you know, scrambling in your head of like, you know, what am I going to do? And am I going to survive this? And do I want to survive this? And I really actually, I think the timing of that question, this question is great, because I finally got around to watching Joseph Campbell's series on the myth. And I watched it while I was, you know, I don't really have television, and, or, you know, I have to go, if I watch Netflix once in a while, I have to go to a place, a neighbor's, and download and then bring it back and watch it in my yurt and all that stuff. And I finally got a chance to watch all six episodes and The Power of Myth, and sat there, and he really articulated it for me. I think it really became a point of just following my bliss, as corny as that may sound to some folks. And the way I grapple with it is not trying to control things. And that's really been the extent of my wife and I, our journey thus far, is really trying to let go of the idea of that I can really control anything. Now, obviously, I can make decisions and things like that. But, you know, things on the level we're going to talk about here, abrupt climate change and, you know, the fossil fuel economy, and the devastation, both human and non-human, the tolls it takes, I have really no control over those things. And so what I find is a lot of the people that you and I follow, talk to, and, you know, interact with on social media, it seems to me they kind of get stuck into the idea of talking about it to the point where it just depresses the shit out of them on a daily basis, and they get down. And yeah. I have a good balance that, because I have a partner, my wife, who is a very solid foundation in my life, and she doesn't follow all that shit. Now, she understands what's going on, and she's very clear about what's happening. You know, we're on the same page as that. And I also live in a community where folks generally are there and have been doing this much longer than I have for a particular reason. They knew the jig was up right away and that this was all BS. And so I'm very fortunate to be able to set boundaries and live with what, you know, I've referred to in my book, the predicament that we are in, and that, you know, I can't control it. But what I can do is make choices to navigate it in a way that seems sane and healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, and I think this is what gets me is how to make those decisions, you know, how, like, what's the first step? I mean, for you, everybody's in a different position. You know,
right.
I, you know, like, I think I was listening to something you had said on a previous interview or in some, something that you had recorded, but it was, you know, we're on this treadmill that we can't get off of, right? In order to live on this planet, or at least within this territory that we call the United States, or you know, so many other places in the world that have labels attached to them, you have to work to live. You have to do something in order to keep you alive, and that requires selling your time and your energy over to something else for at least however many hours a day or a week.
Right.
And that's always been the internal struggle that I've had. You know, I've met a few people, and I don't know what your position is, but people who have had successful careers in something, and they were able to have enough resources at their disposal that they could just yeah, it would require sacrifice on their part, but they would just step away and say, I'm, you know, right. I did my thing and I didn't like it that much, but I got a lot out of it monetarily, and I could just step away. And I think the situation for so many people is it's not as simple to just, you know, drop that part of existence, you know, just to say like, I can't, right. I don't want to work in the system anymore. And I think so many people are fed up with the way things work, but it is a depressing notion when you are grappling with what you've grappled with, which is abrupt climate change, the potential near-term extinction of the species, the rapidly disintegrating ecosystems, and, you know, the biosphere is falling apart. And I mean, all of this is really hard to grapple with, and then you have to go to work on top of that. I mean, it's a real, right. it's a mind fuck. It's really, it forces you to compartmentalize your life, where work is a different reality than, you know, the reality that we're actually within, that you're thinking about. It's something that I've just been frustrated with throughout most of my adult life. And I think many people feel that way as well. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that. Yeah.
Well, that you've articulated it perfectly. It is this dual existence between, you know, what's actually happening in the world, and then, you know, what we think we're doing rather than what we're actually doing, you know. And on some level, we're all, and I'm not blaming anybody here, we're all wage slaves. We were born into a particular system where we no longer have a skill set to really go and keep ourselves alive. We are highly subsidized on some levels. And so there is not really a choice. We're born into a set of circumstances, and rarely do we actually really question the root of what's happening to us. I mean, you've done that, obviously, and Rob's done it, and a number of other people have done it. I've done it. But, you know, okay, so you do that, and then what? You know, you're right, you have to look at your particular situation. I just finishing up recording a video series that I did with Dean Spillane Walker, and it's basically a four-part series, and I try to articulate it, and it's difficult, and it's just called Another Way. And it's really about looking at your own particular set of circumstances and determining what you can possibly do to really kind of, you know, not only follow your bliss, but keep your sanity and live within the world that we are in. Obviously, you know, we have family and we have spouses, we have children, some of us, and those decisions that you make are going to impact all those particular people. But I think it comes down to kind of looking at what we have in common. And I live with a group of people who have come from a variety of different backgrounds, specifically socioeconomic backgrounds. Some come from wealth, some come from poverty, and then some come from, you know, the middle class. But we've all ended up on a property in our lifetimes, and we've all really pursued what I kind of call, and we don't talk about it in this terms necessarily, but we pursued the privileged stance, and for some of us, a voluntary poverty. So I left with my wife with some money, because we both taught high school for, you know, about a decade each. And we both had some money to spend. And so we had time and the luxury to really make some decisions and figure out what we wanted to do. Some of the folks, and most of the folks I live with, are much older than me. I'm 51 years old. Most of the folks I live with are in their 60s and 70s and have been doing this since the 1970s and left with a lot less money, if any money at all. What I did, they just kind of went out there and, as they say, put themselves out in the world and things happen. I wasn't as brave, and it took me a long time of living with them to really go, you know, what am I so fearful of? I left in 2011, and really till about 2015, I was still worried about my dwindling savings. But then I started to look at the folks that I lived with who did not have a savings and left with no savings, and have been living for decades without a savings. And I thought, you know, I'm so fortunate to live with these people who I consider to be elders, and I'm just trying to absorb all the wisdom I possibly can from them and look at the variety of circumstances we all came from and look at what we have in common. And the things that we generally had in common were we were all indebted to a wage slave system, which put us all in some level, depending on how long we were participating in debt. And that's generally the things that hold folks back. And then you throw on other things like, well, if you don't have a job, you don't have health insurance. And if you don't have health insurance, you know, then what? And so a lot of this is projection of what could possibly happen. And that's what our culture is. It's about, you know, it's future based. It's about making money and it's about upward mobility and trying to get to another place. And what I've decided to do, and it wasn't, you know, a new idea, and I came across folks who've been waiting for me to show up for a long time, it seemed, to overcome my fear, is pursue downward tranquility. And so I make just enough money to basically, like you said, keep myself and my wife, you know, going. We're not in poverty by any stretch of the imagination, as the term goes. We took a very privileged route to get where we're going. But I don't pursue to put a savings together, and I'm certainly not pursuing to buy a bigger house and all that. What I'm trying to do is still, after 7 years, is get rid of the shit I've accumulated and the attachment to those things and what I think life should be. So,
yeah, that's a good way to approach the predicament that we are in, because I mean, if it's all going up anyway, I mean, why are we so attached to this false outcome that, you know, we think is gonna, it's kind of that dualism or the compartmentalization. It's like existing in two realities at the same time, where it's like, I know that things are going the way they're going, everything is pointing in that direction, but what if we still have time and I still need insurance and I still need all these things to prepare myself for it, for when I retire or something, right? And every sign is pointing towards that not being a problem. Like, we're not going to be worried about that. That's not going to be a part of the equation any longer. So we need to kind of have a more realistic and grounded view. And you know, you talk about your privileged background, and I think privilege is like this thing that I've had a few different conversations with people that have talked about this. I remember a conversation with a writer named Tad Hargrave. Sorry for saying your name wrong, Tad. Tad Hargrave. He was talking about how privilege, like when this country, when, because he's from Canada, and we're here in the United States, but you know, very similar histories. You know, people think Canada's this like, oh, it's like America, but you know, nicer. And I'm like, well, they still have their genocidal history, and their you know, prime minister kind of reminds me of a more liberal exemplar of liberalism as, hey, Obama, but he's just much more two-faced in the way that he deals with like oil production, for instance, and how he's actually treated the indigenous communities of Canada. I mean, it's obviously not an ideal situation up there by any means. But something we discussed is this idea of whiteness and being where we are labeled white because of our skin color and our ancestry. Of course, we're European. So we exist within a sphere of privilege. We exist within a system that has been built to benefit us in certain ways that we don't always recognize. And when you're talking about stepping away in some way from the system as it is and recognizing your privilege, I mean, I want you to kind of talk a little bit about how privilege maybe shields us or hides some of the underlying violence that pervades our culture, right? We don't always see where it is or what is really like making the world work for us right now. But I just wanted you to maybe comment on that.
Well, that's great. You know, it's, I think I really first came across this idea that you just brought up about what we don't see from the Unabomber. I read the Unabomber's manifesto, Ted Kaczynski's manifesto, and he talks about hidden relationships of the industrial model. And the hidden relationships are, you know, the things you don't see or hear or feel about, you know, the things that show up on the shelves or the services that are, you know, provided for you to choose from in your life. They just kind of happen. And living in community on a smaller scale, I live with about 12 people on about 20 acres. And the difference is, you know, we're still part of the industrial model and we go to stores and we try and grow food and blah, blah, blah. But we know when each other are suffering. You know, if somebody is during the winter, their house isn't keeping them warm, you see that suffering up close. And so there's nothing hidden about it. And you can either just continue to watch that happen, or you can, as a community member, rally the troops and do something about it. And that's often what has happened in the community I live in, as opposed to the neighborhood that I came from, where I didn't know the people that lived directly behind me. A cinder wall basically separated us for 16 years. And I'm sure that household changed occupants several times, and I never knew who they were. I didn't know if they were suffering, if they were healthy. I didn't know what race they were, what gender they were. And I think that's the problem with the industrial model, is we try and govern and support billions of people, and we have these nation states, and you can't govern 350 million people. Clearly, you can. It's a clusterfuck, as James Howard Kunstler would say. And so that is the key, is recognizing, where you fall in that hierarchy. And I think when I talk to a lot of white folks, and particularly white men, they have they pull back and they have this reaction that they're somehow being threatened, or they're, being coerced into feeling guilty about their particular set of circumstances. And what I try and point out is, it's not about really guilt. It's about realizing where you are and what that means, and what that means to other people. And it really comes down to, when people tell me that they are suffering, and let's say I can't see it, it's not on my property, and their people are being killed, or they're being I believe them, because why wouldn't I? I expect them to believe what I would say of my experience in my people. And so that's what I find funny, is that most of the folks that I talk to, where I have, they turn into arguments, is that they don't believe, or they don't want to believe, the experiences of other people. And if you just start to realize, where does all this shit come from, and who's paying the cost, and who is suffering, human and non-human, you start to get an inkling of what's really happening here. So it's not about feeling bad for being white. It's about knowing what it means, and what it means to the relationships you have with life on this planet. So that's really, when you start to go down that rabbit hole, you find that it's a predicament, because can I really, just because I quit my job, I live very little money under the poverty line, I live in a yurt, I live in an intentional community, can I really walk away from my privilege, is the question. And I don't know the answer to that. I show up in, Phoenix, Arizona here to do a house sit. I'm still a white guy. I'm still walking the street as a white man. The police still see me as a white guy. Women still probably are, walking through dark parking lots and trying to get to their car because they're afraid of men. So my male privilege of not having to do that is still relevant. So I don't really know. That's the predicament, is we've really gone down this avenue of this massive hierarchy. And somehow we think by just voting and passing policies and getting the right people in office and recycling and eating at, Trader Joe's, that we can somehow get out of it. All it really does is make us feel better about it. And really what I'm doing on some level is really only making myself feel better about it. Me living in a tent in the middle of nowhere in New Mexico isn't going to change shit. But what it has done is it's kept my sanity, and it's changed my lens to be more empathetic to the plight and situations of people and species that I'm not a part of. And, that, if anything, I think, been beneficial to the way I navigate the world.
Yeah, and I think that it's like you're peeling back the layers, right? So the first layer might be that I am a male. I think that might maybe be if there's a hierarchy of privilege, I think maybe being white or male, I'm not sure which comes ahead of each other, but there's a certain, yeah, certain privilege. Because I've been thinking a lot about this Supreme Court justice controversy with Kavanaugh, not so much to discuss the dynamics of what happened or didn't happen. The media, of course, fixates on, can we really trust this person is telling the truth or not? And I'm like, I understand that that's maybe relevant. But it's really more of a question of the layers of privilege that men experience, where living in a culture where women often feel threatened to just even do the most basic things that we take for granted to be normal. Things that never occur to me, like you mentioned walking to your car at night. Why would that be a frightening proposition for a person, or a frightening situation for a person? You imagine how bad it really is when most women are prepared to fight somebody just to get to their car. You know what I mean? Like things like that. I think Derek Jensen has written about this or has spoken about this, where he talked about walking at night to a Denny's while he's on a book tour, and he told that story to a woman, and she's like, "I would never dream of doing that. Like, are you crazy? Like that would never happen. I would never walk alone at night in a strange town." And I work in the customer service industry. I work, I make coffee, so I'm working with people all the time. I work with mostly women. I've worked in other jobs where I've had so many instances where I've seen men act different towards me versus a woman. It's just so strange to realize that we exist within maybe get back to what I was saying, is just the layers of privilege, because then you strip it back and you realize, like, well, we're human beings. What privilege do human beings have on this planet within this civilization? And then you start to strip that back even further and you realize, like, the whole exploitive nature of the whole thing. And so I think there is this sense of it can feel a bit like nihilism or something, but this sense that I can't get out of this. Like, this whole thing is so pervasive, and that's the thing, is like, when you brought up the Unabomber, I think what was so captivating about him is obviously he bombed people and killed people, and he did it for specific purposes, but his critique wasn't wrong. His critique of industrial civilization was hitting all the points. And I think when people see, like, oh, this guy was trying to live by himself in the woods and you know, try to live, you know, in a more primitive life that he was talking about, maybe through his, you know, in his manifesto, talking about how we need to get away from industrial culture. You know, he was at least trying to do that in some form, maybe not very successfully, because I think there was a real lack of community in his life. And I think that's actually the thing that people tend to miss. And all of this is that, like you're talking about, you're getting away from the center of this thing and you're moving to the fringes, but you're trying to seek something that has been more recently stripped away, which is community and the alienation that comes with being a part of this system, of course. So people are trying to find community in all kinds of strange and peculiar ways. And through the lens of capitalism, community gets transformed into all kinds of strange, perverted forms. Like I was thinking about sports teams and this weird, and it's all over the world, but it's this like community of people that really their only common interest is that they love a sports team, and they create this like tribalistic mentality around it, and they create all of these rivalries between other groups. And to me, that's just like a manifestation of this pervasive alienation that exists within the system that we are a part of. And so seeking community in any form is a innately human thing. And we have certain needs when it comes to that, but it gets channeled into all these strange forms. And that to me always disturbs me, because that's where more dangerous ideas can really take hold of people, you know? And I think that's where we're at right now, honestly.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, I lived with my wife, and I lived with my parents for 16 years. We shared a house, which, you know, in doing that in the United States is just seen as, you know, ridiculous for some people, but it's a common thing in a lot of countries. And so we didn't really think anything of it, mainly because we didn't really give a shit what people thought. And we really loved my folks, and we had what we didn't really identify at that point is a community. And so when Karen and I left and went out on the road to work on homesteads and try and pick up, you know, some sort of skill set, because generally all we knew how to do was talk about things, we discovered that it was beneficial that we lived with my parents for that long, because it was a community, and we learned how to be not only adaptable into new households that we were entering, but we were very flexible in our interactions, and we didn't hold true to, you know, this is the way it's got to be, because we had not lived on our own since our first year of our marriage. And so once we went on the road and we started living with folks, it wasn't always easy, you know, and there were conflicts, but we learned how to navigate that space really well. And we decided basically from doing that, that we no longer really wanted to do what, you know, what Ted Kaczynski did, as he brought up, is go out there and, you know, be this rugged individualism type lifestyle and live out in the woods by ourselves, because it's a lot of fucking work. And we were working on people's properties because they needed help, and they had somewhat on some level done that. They were in a very rural area, and they'd taken on a lot of, they basically taken their urban habits and brought them to a rural area, which made them even more exasperated. And it was more difficult for them because they no longer had the convenience of running to the store. And so we figured out real quick that that's not what we want to do. And we wanted to find community. And so we started looking at communities and what that meant. And, you know, like anything else, in a culture that has not been raised in community, and then they decide they're going to start forming communities, those communities are just as dysfunctional as the, you know, neighborhoods and the lifestyles they came from, because they're bringing all their baggage and all their, you know, their the way things should be with them. And we were fortunate enough to find a community that really wasn't based on how it should be. It just kind of happened organically, and by, you know, some sort of miracle, we found it and fit in really well. And all the heavy lifting had been done before I got there. And so we were really fortunate in a lot of ways, but I can't imagine doing this on my own. One, you know, we're social creatures, and two, I don't want to spend 16 hours a day, gardening and raising animals and doing that. I'd rather share those tasks with people and enjoy the fruits of the labor. So,
yeah. Well, this idea of the rugged individual, I mean, it's an American idea. I think we need to understand It comes out of an American context. But, you know, there's a reason why we, if you look at just even the recent past, you know, human beings did, like you said, there was a sharing of tasks. Like, everybody has a part to play in the community, and everybody takes whatever role that they need to take up at that time. And so the workload isn't, like you said, it's not just one person that's trying to do everything on their own. And any time something goes wrong, you know, they're screwed. You know, that shouldn't be the way it is. There should be a whole network of people that are there to support you and you them, and this sort of reciprocal sharing and everything that comes with being a part of a community. It reminded me when you talked about when people bring all their baggage with them from living in an individualistic setting and then trying to live in a community setting, and they don't know how to do that. It reminds me a bit. I know you've talked with Stephen Jenkinson before, and I reference him a lot just because he's just so poignant. You know, he just always hits it right on the head in a way that you never really thought of could be said in the way that he says it. But but he talks about his most recent book was on elderhood, and something he said that was really profound, which is this idea that if we live in a culture that is bereft of elderhood, if we don't know what elders look like anymore. And not, it's not a matter of age, it's a matter of the role that you play within a community or within the culture. If we don't see that anymore and we don't know what that looks like anymore, we won't be hungry for it. We won't desire it. We won't know what it even feels like to have it in our lives anymore. So if community is, and I see all these like neurotic behaviors emerging in our society because I think that community has dissolved so much and has disappeared so much from people's lives. They don't know where to place their anxiety. They don't know why they feel the way they do, but it probably stems from this real almost biological need to be in a community. But intellectually or even emotionally, they may not understand that's what they're looking for. And I find that if we don't have models to see how community really can work, then we may not be able to find it ultimately at all. And I think absolutely. It's quite an amazing thing that you somehow stumbled your way, or maybe it stumbled. Maybe it was, I imagine that every decision you made was purposeful, and with in your mind you were thinking of like what you wanted. So ultimately you found it, but you just sort of came across this community that had already formed and had already developed some of these more healthy dynamics within the community that you could kind of adapt to. And we need more and more of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. That's the thing. I mean, we did a lot of things with purpose. We knew what we wanted to do, but finding this community was pure chance at a lot of levels. It just happened to be near the first place that we worked on a homestead. It happened to be down the road, and so that we went to visit that place for, they had potluck every Sunday, and we went, you know, we visited another community, and I've read books about communities, but it ultimately came down to that was the place, and it's filled with elders of all ages and genders and in backgrounds. And I didn't know the concept of an elder really until I started to unravel my own conditioning and really get out on the road and start meeting people and coming to the conclusion that I don't know shit. I mean, I taught high school for 12 years and, I felt pretty good about what I did and how I approached it. But there are levels of wisdom out there that I'm just beginning to scratch the surface of the individuals that I live amongst, and in trying to absorb all I can from them while they're still around and while I'm still around and we're together, because, you know, things change very quickly and things could change even more rapidly. But that idea that Jenkinson brings up of elders, and I need to read that book because I love Die Wise, so is very important. And you're right. In when I was watching The Power of Myth, Joseph Campbell was talking about that, you know, we no longer have myth in our lives, in the role that plays about giving us clues about how to navigate our own self-reflection. Well, that those things come from elders, and we don't have any elders. And I'm 51 years old, and I'm finally starting to delve into who I am and what I am and what is life and what am I doing here and what does this mean? And I mean, I thank the universe for, somehow tapping me on the shoulder or however it happened to just go, okay, you know, it's time to start to finally open your eyes a little bit and wake up and see what's really going on and what's really going on within you and what you're doing and how you're thinking about the world and all that. So I've been very fortunate and I'm very grateful for the people I live with, because I, unlike most people who, you know, I follow online and talk about these subjects, the reason they're online all day is because they're craving these conversations, and I get to have them in person, not only with my wife, who I consider an elder, but, a dozen other people. And I can, you know, I can just walk next to my neighbor or down to our community kitchen and have those conversations on a daily basis. And I try and tell people about it, but it's mind blowing. It really is, and we're incredibly fortunate. And I'm incredibly grateful. So,
right, you know, for me, part of doing this project, this podcast, has been a way to just have these conversations, because I'm not having them very much very rarely do I have a conversation about these subjects we're talking about in my actual place. And I think that that's like you're talking about, people are getting online and they're having these conversations and they're almost obsessively looking at it, the information, because it's become their connection to other people that are coming into this, and it's like over and over again, and it's on a Facebook group, so, you know, like these people are distraught for very obvious reasons, for very legitimate reasons, that I have a spouse that doesn't understand what's happening, or they don't want to learn, they don't care, I'm tired of going to a job where we're still exist within this paradigm that doesn't make sense, over and over again, people are not only upset that we are approaching a massive extinction event on some level, and that we're causing it or that we are implicated in it, but not only that, but then they have to go and pretend that everything's fine with everybody else around them. I mean, it's like the big...
It's a fucking madhouse.
It's terrible. I I've been struggling with this for some reason. I don't know what it was. I think it was yesterday. I go through these like phases almost where I'm stable and I'm fine, But then for some reason yesterday, I don't know what it was. It was a series of little interactions that kind of tipped me in this place that I feel like I'm in at this moment, which is a state of almost vulnerability and a sense of like, I don't know what direction I need to take my passion, because it's there's no map, you know, this is all uncharted territory for everybody that's coming into this awareness. It's so frightening to come to that recognition that we are in this place and that nothing is going to really change it or stop it from happening. Not that that should exclude action or that should exclude some sort of, you know, something, right? Like, I think people should do something, but it not with this false hope, right? Not with this false optimism, this sort of cheery, like, oh, we'll figure it out. Because that sort of, I think, stems from the very problem that got us into this position we're in anyway, which is this like problem solving mentality. Like, we can fix every problem we have. And the reality of the situation is this is a predicament. This isn't a problem. This is a predicament. This doesn't have a clear cut solution to it. Anyway, so I think all of us enter into these various stages and phases of despair and grief, and how we choose to react to world events as they unfold. There's no answer, you know. And then,
no, there isn't.
Yeah. And learning from people like you know, you're charting your territory, and I think that that's inspirational. I think that gives people some sense of like, oh, this guy, he was a teacher. I mean, he did it. He figured something out. He's smart, and he kind of like navigated his way out of it. I think, you know, it's your path's gonna, everybody's path's gonna be a little different, but you know, knowing that it's possible opens up the door for so many people. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think, you know, I think what people have to realize on some level is these paths that we've mentioned are not just going to generally always pop up in your head. Like, I've been thinking about my quote unquote escape route since kindergarten. You know, I was put in line in single file line because I was crying, because I knew my life was about to radically change. You know, one minute I was getting up when I wanted, and the next minute I had to be somewhere. And I knew things were, you know, that something was changing drastically. And then, you know, when I got out of college and I got in a car and drive to work and I'm sitting in traffic, my first thought, and I remember it clearly, was how do I get out of this? I don't want to have to do this. And is this what really life is? And so I've thought about this, and it took me till I was, you know, 43, 44 years old to go, okay, I think I got it figured out. And I just stumbled. I just happened to be looking something up, and I came across the idea of working on homesteads. And I was like, holy fuck, this is it. I talked to my wife, and by some freaking luck and miracle, whatever you want to call it, she was on board. And that never happens, by the way. and so we were, you know, we gave ourselves a 3-year window, like, let's do this. And then we watched two movies, and I told the story before. We watched Up and we watched Revolutionary Road, were about two couples that were, you know, had this dream of, you know, going off on their own and escaping the rat race, and they put it off too long and their window closed and something tragic happened. And we're like, okay, fuck that. We're doing it next year. We're going to finish the school year out and we're gone. And the, you know, what it takes to do that, are you have to take some, for me, it was taking risks or taking chances that weren't really risks or chances, because, you know, I had this, we talked about privilege. I had this huge safety net under me. And if things didn't go well, I could go back and be a teacher. I could rebuild my credit score, you know, I could do all that stuff and get a house again and live in, you know, a stucco McMansion if this just didn't work out or it was too hard or whatever it was. So it's not really, for me, it wasn't as big a risk, but that conditioning of, you know, people worried about, you know, what are you going to do without health insurance? What are you going to do without a steady income? You know, what are you going to do without a car, and so on and so forth? And you don't know how to do anything. And I'm like, yeah, that's the whole point. And if it doesn't work out, then I'll come back. But at the same time, even though I knew I could do that, you know, the 40 some years of conditioning in me and the fear that this culture places on you, I would lay in bed at night worrying about, again, like I mentioned earlier, my dwindling savings. My wife was fucking cool as a cucumber. And I was like, shit, you know, how much money we got left? How much money we got left? How much money we got left? And I, like I said earlier, until I got to live amongst folks who had done it much earlier than I did, and with much less fear, I finally was put at ease. And I was like, you know, the thing, Patrick, that happened is when I actually ran out of my savings. I literally had a coffee can and we were under $100 to our name. And I went, that's it. And I actually felt the weight of the world come off me when I had $80 left. I was like, holy shit, I'm okay. It's fine. Nobody here is going to let me die. And I just made a breakthrough. And I was like, wow, that's what it took for me. I had to actually get to the point where I could see the last, you know, $80 of cash in my name between the two of us. So, you know, and she probably earned more of it. So I've had like $8 to my name, you know. So
yeah, yeah.
But that's what it took. And so here I am.
Yeah, and I mean, and once it's almost a burden that you describe there. You know, people think of it as something else. They think of it as like money is opportunity, but money comes with all of these maybe hidden or invisible, I almost want to say like relationships or hidden burdens. I mean, there's a real. I do kind of understand what you mean. Like if you don't have that resource available to you anymore to rely upon, you then have to expand your focus a bit and say, well, what's around me that's actually like, if you're living in a community, especially, you're not going to be as worried about it because you're like, well, I've got people around me that are going to make sure I don't die, that I don't starve to death, that I have shelter, that I'm taken care of. And that opens you up in a certain way to see what's really around you. It's like, it's just a funny thing that the privilege, once stripped away, it allows you to look back in on what you were experiencing before with a new perspective. I guess go on.
What it did was it took the privilege that I had, money, and that once that, you know, that privilege was gone, I actually realized still the immense privilege I had. You know, I wasn't living in a refugee camp in Syria. I was living, you know, 5 hours due east of my folks who, you know, would probably give me money anytime I ever needed it. I lived amongst folks who would give the shirts off their back to me. I had an incredible wife who has much stronger work ethic than I have. I had an education where I could go back and get a job at a pretty good, decent pay. So I was, what it did is that moving away from that part of my privilege really exposed to me the immensity of the privilege that I still had, and that all this fear and worry that I had about these things was completely fucking fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, what you're talking about, your community, I mean, essentially what you're discussing is anarchism. You're discussing minimal hierarchy or little to no hierarchy involved in that. Everybody's sort of working together and dividing the labor amongst, you know, there's a real volunteerism there, I imagine. And, you know, I know that sociologists have discussed this, have researched this, but this thing that happens when, I think they noticed it in with Hurricane Katrina, when that whole region was flooded and all these people, before even FEMA could even do anything, people were already forming communities and networks to help each other out. I mean, it wasn't ideal, but people, when they get into the situation, were like, oh, we don't have the government here to save us. We don't have money. We don't have all of these resources available. Well, it's like an instinct kicks in. Once that safety net of civilization or whatever it is disappears, people just assume we have this thing, and it's fed to us. It's a form of subtle or not so subtle propaganda. This idea that if we don't have government, if we don't have the free market or whatever it is, right? We don't have these structures in place anymore. Things are just going to fall apart. People are going to resort to their worst nature, and they're going to start exploiting each other, and violence is going to ensue as a result. Oftentimes, it goes the other direction. You know, I mean, I imagine there's a spectrum of what could happen, but a lot of times people kind of find each other and recognize like, oh, I have neighbors and we can like have a common goal to sort of find some way of living together. And that almost happens instinctually in these disaster scenarios. And to me, this has kind of been it's a weird stance to take, I think, for many people, but this idea that by recognizing our imminent demise. Say, just at the very least, let's just say our civilization is built on an unsustainable premise in that it is going to collapse. Let's just even remove the idea of abrupt climate change and ecological devastation, right? That could pose a, you know, existential threat to humanity as a whole. So if that is on the table, which it very much is, my whole thing has been like, if you can recognize that this is real and that this is happening, that you're going to want to approach life differently, and that in turn can actually make you live more beautifully or live with more purpose. It almost seems like people want, when I bring up, okay, abrupt climate change may very well destroy the future of our species. We may not be able to exist any longer on this planet. People think that, well, you're just trying to depress people. You're trying to disempower them from taking action. And I say, actually, I think it's a multi-stage process, because once you get to that recognition that, yes, we are doomed, well, that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm asking you that you should just give up on life. What it should do is it should empower you to take the actions and the steps that you've always wanted to take on some level. This should actually be something, almost paradoxically, by recognizing our extinction, it'll actually make us want to live more fully and actually engage with each other more fully and actually take more actions to maybe undermine the legitimacy of the structures that still exist. That may be the very thing that makes life maybe not continue, but at least better.
It's paradox. That's, you hit it right on the nose. That's it. It's really the people that are going to have struggles with this collapse are the people who have incredible attachments to their shit and what they want to protect. You know, if you just look at Katrina, like you brought up earlier, and what happens, you know, you have people who basically didn't have much but came together, and other people trying to block those people from crossing bridges into their particular parish who had shit that they felt they needed to protect because they just assumed everybody's going to want their shit. And, you know, instead of going, I think this process, like you mentioned, people, this is an opportunity to really delve into what it is you are attached to and really start to go, is that a legitimate thing that I'm attached to? Is it causing me harm? Is it healthy? What is it? Where has it led me? And what has it led me to do or to continue to do? And that's all that, you know, my wife and I have really done, is we've taken an opportunity to go, okay, what does this mean for us? And, you know, how do we want to go forward? Do I want to live in a world where, you know, people are killing one another or just trying to survive? No, I'm not going to fucking protect the few things I have. I don't give a shit. I don't want to live in a world like that. But I do – I'm okay dying in a community of people that I love and living a life that I wake up and have full intent and purpose every day and get to do what I want when I want. And so it is – it's a great opportunity to not, you know – To instead of, you know, trying to survive this and building yourself a bunker with a bunch of guns and water and some canned goods, is to really build the relationships that you've never really tried to build before. You know, meet that person on the other side of that cinder block wall that you haven't met in your neighborhood. You know, go to events that are community based, and make the spaces that you live in now communities, because you don't have to live and go move into a tent in New Mexico to have community. You can start building it from the people that you have lived next to for years. And so it is. It's an opportunity, and I think people often go and resort back to their conditioning, which, again, we've discussed throughout this entire conversation. It's about, you know, this country is built on fear, and it's tough to shed that.
Yeah. It is really tough to shed it, and I think everybody's going to come at it in their own unique, individual way, and that's, I think that's probably the scariest thing, is there is no map. there's no answers.
No, there's no map.
Yeah, it's all, like, I don't know, a combination of, I guess, just thinking and learning, and but also being grounded and humble, and there's a whole bunch of different things that I think individuals have to work on within themselves, you know, however they choose to approach it. But there's things they have to do within themselves so that they can begin that process of I don't know. I mean, it's again, there's no answer. So you just have to kind of, and I think that's the hardest thing about all of it is, we want answers. You know, we want to assume that there is somebody who has at least somebody has an answer. Right. And, this sort of fixation on finding a leader that's going to lead us out of this, this dilemma that we find ourselves in. Yeah.
Well, my neighbor who was a hobo for 20 years, he told me a story. He had a conversation with a guy who was next to, my neighbor was dumpster diving and he met this man and they struck up a conversation and the guy was like, this is, I think in St. Louis or something. He said, man, I want to live my life like you. And he goes, well, you know, you can. He goes, yeah, but how do I do it? He goes, well, right up there is an on-ramp to a highway and you just walk up there and you put your thumb out. And the guy's like, well, I can't do that. He goes, you know, what am I going to do for work? He goes, well, that's the whole point. You're not going to do that anymore. He basically said to me, he goes, if you want something to happen, you actually got to put yourself out there. Now that doesn't mean you have to go and, you know, hitchhike and become a hobo, but you actually have to do something. So people, as we talk about people online, we like to conceptualize things and theorize things, but there comes a point when you actually have to go and take some action on a personal level. And that's, I think if I'm proud of anything, I'm proud that I did that. I spoke and talked to my students for years about, you know, taking a stance and doing things. And I said, well, I'm really just talking. And so I did it and it was scary. It was frightening, but I love the life I had, but it doesn't even compare to the life I'm living now. So.
Right. Yeah. It's like making that choice opens up the world to you. Right. And so much more is able to happen because you've decided to step away from something and towards something else. You may not know what that is, but you're gonna, you know, you'll get there eventually. It's like, man, I'm trying to think of, when I spoke with Charles Eisenstein, you know, he was really influential in my thinking because something he was able to write about and articulate was this idea that we live within stories, that we live within the story of our civilization, the story of humanity, this idea that we are progressing, that we're a part of this great human project of ascent. And that story is falling apart. So what's happening is a new and old, very ancient story is reemerging. Now, we are in a space between stories. We're in a space of unknowing. We're in a space that doesn't have a way out, doesn't seem like we know any answers to any of the questions that we have. And being in that space, while very frightening and obviously you don't know anything, I mean, that's the whole thing. It's absolutely necessary on that journey to get to where we should be and to find that right role, you know, as a species, but also as individuals. And that's so hard for people to kind of to get there.
Yeah, you know, Americans love adventure, and this would be the biggest adventure of your life, and that is dissecting the story you tell yourself about yourself. And once you start to dissect that, that's what I did, is really, you know, delving into what I believed and what I, you know, and how I was acting based on those beliefs. And once I started to peel those layers, that's the biggest adventure journey you could ever take. You know, people like to go and do extreme things in this country and all these quests and vacations. But really the biggest one you could take is really delving into your personal narrative, because it's obviously been, you know, influenced and given to you by our collective narrative, which, as we've talked about, is bad math. You can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And I'm not a math guy, and I know that one.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Mike, I just want to point people towards your work. I think we've had a really great discussion. It went a little all over the place, but I kind of like that because that's sort of how I'm feeling right now. a little all over the place. Cool. So I thank you for being open to having that discussion with me. And
absolutely.
And I know that you have your blog, Mike Sliwa. wordpress.com. Again, your last name is spelled Sliwa, or it's Michael.
Yeah, it's Michael Sliwa.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah. Michael, I should say your full name correctly. I apologize. At wordpress.com. And then you also have your book, Chasing a Different Carrot, a manifesto for the predicament of privilege. And I know that you've done a TEDx talk. You've done plenty of podcasts. I know that you've done a lot of interviews. So you have a whole bunch of resources that people can find, and I will be sure to provide those down in the description of the episode. I want to ask you, though, if there's any other places that people can find your work, any projects that you're currently working on that we can reference as well.
Yeah, shortly, within hopefully the next couple weeks, I had to redo a couple of these episodes that I've been working on with Dean Walker. And it's a 4-part series called Another Way, and it's really about a lot of the things we talked about, but it's the psychological steps of what it takes really to take that action that we spoke about. So those will be about 4 videos of about 15 minutes each, with some a little bit of homework in them, a little bit of recommended reading, and then if people want more after that, I could do more videos, or they can contact me at my website personally and we can do Skype calls or whatever it happens to be, because it's really about having conversations. And that's what I did. I had conversations about, you know, with people that had done things before I had attempted to do them. And so if I can be of service that way, that's kind of the way to do it.
Yeah. And I'll just say that I was on Dean's video podcast, Poetry Predicament, and it was
great guy.
Yeah. I had a really beautiful conversation with him. He does a really good job of facilitating these really conversations that are actually about vulnerability in this time. And I think he does a fantastic job of going over that and bringing that out in the guests. And so anyway.
Yeah, I think you and Dean and Rob Simons, I think all you guys do a great service. And I appreciate the work you do, and keep doing it, man, because you have a really good show.
All right. Thank you, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a wonderful week, and as a psychedelic bard, Terrence McKenna, said, take it easy, dude, but take it!
As you weren't paying attention either.